Hey, this is Mike Klassen, and welcome to Vancouver Overcast, a podcast where we have conversations with city leaders and innovators. It was 10 years ago this month that Vancouver, British Columbia hosted the world at the 2010 Olympic and Paralympic Games. The event was met with protests. The weather was too mild for a winter sports event. A death of an athlete nearly cast a pall over the entire Games. And billions in infrastructure and security left many wondering if it was worth all the cost. However, today, most Canadians remember it as perhaps our biggest national celebration that launched many of our athletes onto the world stage and made Vancouver, BC one of the most attractive places to visit and invest on the planet. On this episode, we talk with a journalist with an encyclopedic knowledge of the 2010 Games, from its very first pitch to the Canadian Olympic Committee to the dousing of the torch. I'm excited to welcome Bob Mackin, reporter with the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Bob also wrote one of the definitive documents of the game's journey, titled Red Mittens and Red Ink. On this first part of the two-part conversation, Bob and I go back to those early days before the Olympic flame arrived at Jackpool Plaza in Vancouver. And now, it's time for Vancouver Overcast. So I'm very pleased to have Bob Mackin here in the studio for Vancouver Overcast, and we're going to be talking about the 2010 Games. They were 10 years ago this month. The city was alive with tens of thousands of people coming into the downtown core, thousands of people visiting from around the world, and of course the streets were crawling with athletes and all the venues were full, the tickets were sold out, and all the live venues were starting to take off. Bob, before we kind of get really too heavily into going into that time machine, maybe tell me a little bit about your experience around the Olympics. And I know that you've attended several of the games. Maybe tell us a little bit about some of your most fond memories of Olympics past.
Well, my Olympic journey really began in September of 1998, back when Arthur Griffiths was running the bid committee, the bid corporation, trying to get buy-in from the Canadian Olympic Committee, try to get the Canadian Olympic Committee's endorsement to go then to the International Olympic Committee. He had a news conference at BC Place Stadium. It was a news conference on the floor of BC Place Stadium. Nothing else was happening. The stadium was just a very big open cavern that day. And, you know, the tagline for the bid committee at the time was, you know, imagine. So, you know, imagine Vancouver and Whistler coming alive with Winter Olympics, having the best NHL players, having the best skiers, snowboarders, best curlers in the world come to Vancouver. It was all a very romantic notion at the time, and you know, a very optimistic group that was putting on that bid. They were up against Calgary and Quebec City at the time, and you know, I was working as a sports columnist for the Vancouver Courier at the time, and of course, as a sports columnist, to see the potential of this to come to town, your own hometown, was quite enticing. And looking at their plan at the time, they had a kind of a different plan. They were going to put the Athletes Village at UBC, for instance, and they were going to build a venue for curling up at Simon Fraser University, a very early iteration. But at the time, they were hoping to get some community support, of course, but they're hoping to target the members of the Canadian Olympic Committee to get them to vote for it. So that day forward, of course, it was a major sporting event, but as it got closer to the bid, the Canadian Olympic Committee accepting the Vancouver bid and voting for it, and then, of course, taking it to the International Olympic Committee, it began to take on so many different aspects. It wasn't just this major sporting event that you had the romantic notion of going to that news conference. This was a microcosm of everything in the world: geopolitics, civil liberties, Aboriginal issues, the environment, anti-corruption issues, all sorts of things. This was going to be Canada's next Olympics after Calgary, and of course 1976. Calgary, they seem to have executed it pretty well, left with a profit. Montreal, of course, was called by some British media outlets basically the Mafia Games for all the corruption that happened there with the Olympic Stadium and the Olympic Village, and the bills it left out afterwards. you know, Montreal was really derided for what happened there because they were up against the clock and managed it by throwing more money at it. And of course, Jean Drapeau, the mayor of Quebec, sorry, the mayor of Montreal, told the world that the Olympics could no easier lose money than a man could have a baby, his famous quote. And of course, Mayor Drapeau never got pregnant, but the people in Quebec, in Montreal, and the rest of Canada were left with a real brat of a bill afterwards. So that was the start of my Olympic journey back in 1998. I eventually, after Vancouver won the bid, went to Torino in Italy, 2006 Winter Olympics, to see what a Winter Olympics would look like, to experience it firsthand. And that was an invaluable experience, so I could tell the stories of what happened in Turin to Vancouverites on what to expect in 2010, and also make a lot of connections along the way, so I could learn behind the scenes stories of how this event could come together. And of course, I also later went to Beijing for the 2008 Olympics. Of course, Summer Olympics and Winter Olympics, different animals, but as I learned by going to these mega events, they use a similar playbook. It's scaled up or scaled down depending on the size and the scope of the event and what part of the year it's held, but they use a lot of the same elements. It's surprising how similar the organization of a Summer and Winter Olympics is.
When you went to Torino, for example, was it prior to Sam Sullivan's Olympic twirl in his wheelchair? Did you get to watch that on TV, or were you there for the event itself?
The traditional flag handover from the mayor of the outgoing city to the mayor of the incoming city of the actual Olympic flag. So Sam Sullivan was there to do that in front of the world. And of course, he reprised that role later when the Paralympics were held in Turin. And you know, a lot of optimism. You know, coming back to Vancouver, of course, the Inukshuk down in English Bay, which would eventually become a stylized version, would become the logo for the Vancouver Olympics. Mm-hmm. Well, Sam Sullivan went to the lighting ceremony there. And that's after Turin, that's where a lot of controversy started happening. Of course, there was the Battle of Eagle Ridge Bluffs, the Sea to Sky Highway expansion. The provincial government decided not to bore a tunnel through the mountain, instead to bulldoze essentially a forest. And that turned a lot of West Vancouver residents who had not protested before, or
it was the frog population that they were.
The frog population was part of it. The swamp there, it was very concerning to a lot of people there. And of course, Betty Krajcik was there, and one of the Nahanis from the Squamish Nation was involved too. And then a lot of local residents in West Vancouver, even Pam Goldsmith Jones, who eventually became the mayor, she posed. For this nude calendar. Nude calendars were a big thing back in the mid-2000s for fundraisers.
Okay.
Discreetly posed, of course. And mm-hmm. there's actually a photo of Pam Goldsmith-Jones in the Vancouver archives with some of the Vanock artifacts, which are accessible. A lot of them aren't, and we can talk more about that later, but some of the artifacts that they collected in their own files for the games include that. The calendar of West Vancouver residents protesting Eagle Ridge Bluffs by going in the buff and selling these calendars to try to fund their ways and means of the signs. So that was one of the cases where we saw it was really coming, and not only were there bills for building the venues and operating the venues that were going to be coming due eventually, but there was a trade-off that our environment was also being sacrificed in some ways, you know, the old progress, to build or expand a highway, which needed expansion for a long time because it was unsafe for so long.
There's just so much in what you just said there, but when you look back at the Vancouver Games and contrasting them to all the other games that you went to, London, Rio, Beijing, and Torino, was Vancouver, in your view, a successful event?
We could go on for so many so many hours to dissect that. There were successes, there were failures, there were successes where there could have and should have been failures, there were failures where there could have and should have been successes. From the city standpoint, being in the biggest city to host a Winter Olympics until then, they made downtown Vancouver, they made you know, Whistler, Richmond into villages. It really was that kind of atmosphere. They pulled off something special in that aspect. although there were some security incidents, things weren't rosy on Granville Mall all the time. As later it got, in some days, the more rowdy people got, the more drunkenness happened. There were some incidents. There was a man whose neck was slashed. There were also upticks in sexual assault reports. It was not the best of times, even in the public domain there. But for the most part, people were able to celebrate peacefully and have quite a memorable time, especially those who couldn't afford tickets or couldn't access tickets. They were able to go to the various live sites. So from that aspect, that those were images that a lot of people around the world saw on TV. Those were a lot of the ways that Vancouverites were able to access the games. Of course, the cost of the games, we think it's around $8 billion all in for everything, including the infrastructure and the operations of the venues. We never got a real accounting afterwards.
Let me stop you there, because I know that has always been the narrative of particularly the critics, and I think the opposition, NDP at the time, and a number of other social justice activists talked about the cost of it. And I remember, because I was working with Colin Hanson during the lead up to the games, Colin always sort of stuck to the view that this was a the actual operations was about $600 million. And, people scoffed at that number because they saw, the new Canada line being developed. They saw the Eagle Ridge Bluff and the massive redevelopment of the Squamish Highway. But a lot of those things are still with us. A lot of those are genuine legacies, infrastructure that, has made and built and grown our region. So is it fair to say that even though the games were a catalyst, that we should tally those things up as the real cost of the games?
We should look at the costs and the benefits. It's important that when you hold an event like this, that you do look at the costs and benefits to ensure that the money was well spent, that you do identify the successes and the failures, because another city in Canada or another democratic nation and ally, whether it's United States or UK or Australia, might want to hold games like this again. I mean, first is the benefit and the cost for our own taxpayers. It's good to know what did go on. And there were Auditor General reports regularly before the games. Of course, in late 2008, John Doyle was the Auditor General at the time, and he kind of threw up his hands because he said the BC Liberal government at the time wasn't cooperating. Although I always wonder why he didn't just use his authority. The Auditor General has enabling legislation that allows summoning of documents and summoning of witnesses under oath. I don't know why he didn't take that step, because he could have and should have. And then after the games in late 2010, after VanOck issued its financial report, post-games financial report, he decided to close the book and wasn't going to open the book again. So I think the people that we paid to do that work, to ask those questions, failed us. I don't know if there was political interference going on or if they just were focused on other things, but I think it should have been done. In Ontario, they held the Pan American Games in 2015 in Toronto, and not only was the Pan American Games Organizing Committee covered by the FOI law in Ontario, the Auditor General there did an audit afterwards. To again look at the successes and the failures, to see if value for money was achieved, and to see where the waste was, because this was a very big expenditure, a very big investment here in British Columbia. We really put the province's reputation and future at stake, and of course we saw how it cost Gordon Campbell his job eventually, because coming out of the 2009 election, the deficit after the election suddenly was much bigger than what it was supposed to be during the election. And it was the summer of 2009, and there were a lot of worries there after the economic collapse in 2008 that they didn't foresee and they didn't plan for, that the worries were that British Columbia, the guarantor for the games, was not going to be able to fulfill its commitments to the IOC, and that there could be post-games litigation if anything went wrong. That was one of the reasons why the HST came about. There were many other reasons, but that was one of the reasons why the HST came about. And of course, fast forward after the games to the fall of 2010, and Gordon Campbell became the ex-premier. So yeah, he put a lot of his own political capital on the table at risk. to build his administration around the Olympics and to build BC. I mean, this was a massive construction project in so many different construction sites. This was also a massive tourism promotion, a massive real estate promotion. So from those metrics, we have seen in the last 10 years what has gone on in Vancouver, and you can't deny the growth of Vancouver. You can't deny the amount of tourists that are coming here now. The Games did succeed in that promotion. The first couple of years, it was looking kind of thin. 2011, 2012, 2013.
Pretty tough economic times that were coming out of that out of that recession as well.
I was looking at it back then and saying, well, we're not getting the growth or the business investment or the tourism like they sold us on. But then, you know, middle of the decade, it's started to take off. There's been some global trends, of course, and there's of course now concerns about over tourism, about people loving an area so much, going to an area so much, sharing their experiences on social media, seeing what's happening, for instance, the Joffrey Lakes and Quarry Rock in North Vancouver, and even around the Capilano Suspension Bridge, which has become a victim of its own success. So Gordon Campbell's vision to double the size of the tourism industry certainly did come true, and real estate and construction have gone crazy. But even within that, there's a debate now because with the Olympics, we were sold on this idea that we'd all win in some way, but in many ways, not everyone won, and there's been a lot of losers along the way. There's a lot of Vancouverites who supported the Games who 10 years later, when people start talking about it this month, may have second thoughts and say, great, but look what the Games did to the city. It expanded the city, the world came, we invited the world came, but it suddenly became a more expensive city and a lot of people had to move away from the city.
I don't like to always just kind of look at how we did against everybody else, but it seems to me that of the reported experiences of the different games that have happened from Torino, London, Beijing, and Rio, Vancouver seems to have come out fairly well on the other side of it, but as you say, there are a number of these kind of fine concerns that came out of it from the overheating of the economy to the cost of real estate and perhaps even too much enthusiasm for some of these tourism destinations. But are we ahead of where we were in prior to the Games?
Definitely we are. If you're in those businesses, you'd be looking back fondly at the Games because those Games for those 17 days were a massive infomercial that introduced a lot of people in the world to Vancouver and maybe reintroduced some people. It did what Expo 86 wasn't able to do in many ways because Expo 86, you had to be there. Expo 86 really wasn't a television event. Of course, the opening and closing ceremonies were televised. Right. And there was some TV coverage here and there during the game during the Expo 86, but World's Fairs are a different animal. They draw people into the city. You really have to go there and be there and go to the site, whereas Olympics, which have really leapfrogged World's Fairs as an attraction and a media event, are a media event that are beamed around the world. We didn't get the 3 billion viewers of the opening ceremonies like they always told us we would. There was actually about 1.8 billion estimated viewers for the entire Olympics. That's still a lot of people. And a lot of people that saw the games and were exposed to the games throughout other types of media. It was early on in the social media age. There was actually a push by a lot of people in small companies in Vancouver. Hootsuite was in its infancy, and there were some Hootsuite workers early on before the games, a couple years before the games, who were trying to convince the IOC to loosen its media regulations because social media was on the horizon. It was going to change everything, and the IOC kind of dipped its toe in the social media pool. It has embraced it since then, but this really was the first social media games in Vancouver. So that was something which was definitely a boon there. The big media companies coming out of the recession in 2008 didn't make the big profits like they hoped they would. But there was also the case where the British Columbia government had to step in and be a bit of a stopgap. That's the reason behind that $20 million ad campaign that ran on NBC promoting British Columbia tourism. Sarah McLachlan was in there and other British Columbia celebrities were there. So
That was in the run-up to the games, right?
That was in the run-up shortly before the games, but also during the games. So okay. If you're watching NBC during the games...
Were they genuinely worried about not getting the attendance that they were projecting?
Well, everything when the 2008 economic crash happened, everything changed.
Right.
I was in Beijing, covered the Beijing Olympics, and it was the night before the opening ceremony. I actually was with a friend of mine living in Beijing, and we went to this rooftop bar in the old legation quarter, the old embassy quarter, not far from Tiananmen Square, not far from where the BC Canada Pavilion was, mm-hmm. in the museum there. And you know, we were on our way to another event, actually at the BC Canada Pavilion, and coming in were people from Goldman Sachs. And in hindsight, I wish I stuck around there and was a fly on the wall, because those people eventually went back to New York, and some of their friends at Lehman Brothers were out of jobs in September of 2008. That's when everything fell apart. The whole game changed. The whole rules changed, because what happened then, you had the credit crunch. You had the Olympic Village crisis, where City of Vancouver had to make an unpopular decision, which was kept from us for quite a while, but a decision to step in and keep the money flowing, because Fortress Investment Group, the financier for Millennium, the two brothers who were building the village in Falls Creek, that finance fell away because that company walked away. They couldn't afford, after the credit crunch, to keep on funding. You also eventually had General Motors go into bankruptcy. You had Nortel as well have a crisis, and you had a lot of the other sponsors step back and say, well, we're not going to be able to afford to advertise at the games like we hoped. We're not going to be able to afford to send all of our suppliers, our best suppliers, and our top executives to the games. We won't be able to buy as many tickets. We won't be able to buy as many hotel rooms. We won't be able to buy as many souvenirs. And again, you know, the advertising, the billboard advertising in the host city, which is usually divvied up to the sponsors. So throughout the ripple effect of that recession, that forced VanOck to have to go back to governments and ask for more help to find volunteers instead of paid workers. You know, volunteers, a lot of them came from Crown corporations, and also to ask for more money in case of help, more money to help try to balance the budget. And also they had to look at their own budget. So there was talk way back when in 2001, of course, we had 9/11 happen, and that was for many years the big worry, that what if there's another incident like in Atlanta, which happened at the live site there? What if there's another incident like in Munich, which was the terrorism at the Olympic Village? What if that, because the original bid had $175 million for security, it ended up being more than $900 million. That was the big worry for years ahead. And the economic collapse was something that they didn't foresee. And that became the overall story, the biggest challenge they faced going into the games. That was quite a shock, because I found one of the earlier business plans and they didn't even foresee that happening, which I thought was irresponsible in so many ways. And I think in hindsight, if they could go back to their original business plan, I think they would have built that in and said, okay, here are three scenarios, you know, the good, bad, the ugly scenario, the medium, the small, medium, large, or unlikely, possible, and not likely scenarios. I think if they could go back in time, the people who were running VanOck, you know, of course, John Furling, the CEO, but Dave Cobb, the CFO, who really was the one in charge of revenue, I think if they could go back in time, that's one thing that they would fix, is buffer themselves early, prepare for a storm, and hope a storm didn't happen. But the storm did happen, and they weathered it, but they needed more money, more of our money, to help them do it.
My guest is Bob Mackin from TheBreaker.News. We're talking about the 2010 games and the legacy that it's left for Vancouver. And also, really, Bob, you've just been kind of setting up all the trade winds of economic downturn that were happening, a lot of the things that perhaps the game's machinery wasn't really expecting or anticipating, and perhaps not ready for. But the games were scheduled to happen. I know that, for example, you got to be involved in the torch relay. That event alone, I think, really started to get Canada excited about these games.
Well, I was in the torch relay in Edmonton a month before. They they gave a couple spots to some reporters. I was one of them, reporting with Sun Media, 24 Hours Vancouver, and Stephanie Levitz from the Canadian Press was the other. They give us a spot in Edmonton. But my torch relay story goes back even further. I was in Olympia, Greece, for the actual lighting of the Olympic flame in Olympia, in ancient Olympia, at the original Olympic venue, the ancient Olympic venue where they had the sports way back when, where it all started, basically. Mm-hmm. A beautiful place to be. And I thought that this is going to be the event that is going to be the most complex of all the events from so many different aspects, but also the event that was going to touch so many Canadians. I was a witness of the Calgary 1988 torch relay, which came to North Vancouver. It went to the Cleveland Dam, and back then it was Petro-Canada was the sponsor, and they had those little candle torches that they handed out to everyone, and everyone got a chance to, you know, share the flame, basically. They lit the flame to one person's candle, and everyone passed the candle along. So that was a neat event back in 1988. So here I had the chance to go and report on that in Olympia, Greece. The first day there was the dress rehearsal. So we were able to...
And this is the one where they actually took the flame that was eventually going to wind up in Vancouver.
Oh, indeed. Indeed. And in this case, they let us into the actual temple where they do the lighting with their mirror, and the women dressed as priestesses, and they did the ceremony, dry run ceremony, 24 hours before, and lit the torch for the first runner in the torch relay, because they ran it around Greece for about a week or so before they handed it over and was flown to Victoria. So I was there for that, and then the next day was the actual event. They didn't let us into the temple area. They only let a certain group of people in the temple, but we were there anyways in the meadow on the original Olympic venue from way back when. And it was a bittersweet moment, because afterwards there were a couple of us who were reporters from Canada. I went over and spoke with John Furlong and Gordon Campbell, and you know, this was a day that they've been hoping for and waiting for so long. But of course, the one person that wasn't there was Jack Poole. They had earlier, before they talked to us, and I saw them off in a corner on a mobile phone, they'd been speaking to Jack Poole, who was at the time back in hospital in Vancouver, deathly ill. You know, so they were able to wipe away the tears and talk to us and say that they were able to convey the news back to Jack that the Olympic flame had been lit and the torch relay was on. And the next day, I was actually sharing a ride with Jeff Lee from the Vancouver Sun on my way to Athens. We wanted to get lunch, stopped off in a small village called Varda. We were looking for one of these villages to sit down and have a good Greek meal before continuing on for the journey. And I got a call from someone in the CBC Vancouver newsroom who conveyed the very sad news that Jack Poole had passed away.
Wow.
So we were late in our meal and basically ate a few more bites, and then you know, asked the waitress where we could go, what we could do, and Jeff went to the washroom, and we were trying to find a place, a web cafe or whatever, to file a story, a quick story. And I looked out the window, and a place across the street was actually called the Vancouver Cafe.
Mm.
And so we went over and talked to those fellows, a couple of guys, Greek fellows from Greece, who had spent time living in Burnaby, came back to Greece and opened up a cafe called the Vancouver Cafe.
Wow.
So of all the weird things that happened, we meet a couple of fellas from Metro Vancouver, across from a restaurant that we never knew about before, that we kind of stumbled upon. And while we're at this restaurant, we get the bad news, and news that forced us back into action as journalists to file stories from Greece the day after the torch relay had been lit. So that was quite a bittersweet moment, and one of those moments that you say, well, you know, we're almost meant to be here at this time, especially with the Vancouver Cafe across the street, and now us having to file back to our newsrooms in Vancouver with the news of Jack Poole's passing. So, yeah, there was the funeral that happened in Vancouver at Christchurch Cathedral, some of the VanOck executives had to go back to Greece to accept the flame and get on the Canadian Forces jet to come back to Canada. I was there in Victoria when that touchdown happened at the airport, and I followed the torch relay throughout Victoria that day. It was the weather was cool, it was rainy. There was the ceremony on the lawn of the legislature. Simon Whitfield was one of the first runners with it, and passed around throughout the town. And there were protests throughout that day. Protesters who were, of course, chanting the usual slogans of the pre-games protests: "Homes, not games," and "No Olympics on stolen native land."
Yeah.
And they have succeeded in rerouting the torch relay a few times. The torch relay went out of Victoria, went to Elk Lake, where the rowing team had some great visuals, some great pictures with the torch relay out on the lake, came back into Victoria, and there was a live site celebration later that night. I went to a security conference that was held in Vancouver. There are a lot of security conferences because this was a big event for the security industry, both private and public sector. And that's the one where Jamie Graham, the Victoria police chief, boasted to those in the security industry who went to the conference that he had a trick up his sleeve, that he actually put an undercover cop on the bus that carried the protesters from Vancouver by BC Ferries to Victoria. And that became a national news story. And that became the inspiration for a complaint from a Victoria citizen that Jamie Graham may have put a police officer at risk and put some protesters at risk. So that became a story on its own. So the torch went on its journey throughout Canada. Of course, I had my time in Edmonton, and that was quite fascinating. I've got my red mittens, which are different from the others because the maple leaf on the palm is dimpled to allow some traction so you could better onto the torch, although I ran instead of jogged. I had too much adrenaline. I was on the street in downtown Edmonton, not far from the finish near City Hall. It was not a cold day. I was hoping for a cold Edmonton winter day, but it was kind of mild that day. Although there were people over at a bar nearby and there was a pile of snow, so I was prepared for them to pick up some snowballs and hit me. And all I was really worried about was holding on to that torch and not dropping it. I didn't want to have an embarrassing photo happen. It turned out that I kept hold of it and I ran with it instead of jogging. And I also touched part of it after it had been extinguished. So my gloves got a little bit singed, and my hand got a little bit hot too. But
still here to tell the story.
Oh, indeed. And the adrenaline kept me through it, and that was a lot of fun. And there was a band, the B. Arthurs, this band that played the live site at the Edmonton City Hall, this ukulele cover band. And I thought, wow, great, I'll see them afterwards. I didn't get a chance to actually get into the live site and see them because I was still wearing the tracksuit. And so many people in Edmonton wanted to touch the torch, have their photo taken with it, with me. So many friendly people who wanted to be part of the games and to be part of the magic of the games. And so I was fine with missing the B. Arthurs and just meeting all these friendly people. And then had other chances to interact with the torch relay. There was the photo op on a BC ferry near Horseshoe Bay. I went on there. There was the time of the Peace Arch. It actually dipped into the United States for a matter of minutes. And Gordon Campbell was there, and Christine Gregoire, the governor of Washington State, were there. So I was there up and early. That happened at 6 a.m. One day, a couple of days before the games. So followed it there, and of course it came through my neighborhood in North Van. And
the fact that it got into Metro Vancouver, for months before the games actually getting underway here, it felt like the city was almost afraid of them coming. They seemed to be so cautious that they were not issuing any news releases, they were not promoting them in any way. So the city itself didn't seem to be really that activated about it. And I wonder if, in hindsight, what was going on there was the concerns about protests, the concerns about the cost, the concerns about this as being, you know, the divisions between the City Hall and in the province of British Columbia, and even the federal government, because it was a conservative government and we had Vision Vancouver here at City Hall, that nobody wanted to really work together at that point. Do you remember that time period just in the last couple of weeks before the torch actually wound up in BC Place?
Oh, indeed. There was, and actually it was Jack Poole at a news conference earlier in 2009 was reflecting on the challenges that VanOck was facing from an economic standpoint. And he used the words pressure cooker. He said that VanOck was in a pressure cooker environment, and there could not be more true words, because that pressure cooker environment was in City Hall. It was in the provincial government. It was in Ottawa. It was in the sponsors. It was in the media outlets. Everything, it was a pressure cooker. And you could just, you know, cut the air with a knife. And, and that's the way it was in Vancouver. And this concern that, will it be success? What will happen? Should we be worried about protests? And what about the effects of the Great Recession?
You're listening to Vancouver Overcast. My guest is Bob Mackin from the Breaker.News and the Breaker.News podcast. Bob's been giving us a fascinating account of the years, months, and weeks leading up to the Vancouver 2010 Olympic and Paralympic Games. It was a pressure cooker, as he says. This is the end of our first part of a two-part conversation with Bob. In the next episode of Vancouver Overcast, we're going to hear more about the fateful weeks of the games themselves and the legacy that was left for the city of Vancouver. So be sure to subscribe to Vancouver Overcast, tell your friends, rate our program. My name is Mike Klassen. I'm your host. Thanks for listening.